know what? I'm so old school. Jimmy taught my daughter about my daughter, who was my daughter, who's now my son. Jimmy Civetic got my son into poetry. I'm eternally grateful. I've always been a poet. I've always been a poet in my son's eyes, but Jimmy got my son into poetry, and he read here a couple months ago, and you know what? This series is the best thing that Pittsburgh has. It's been going on so long, and I'm so grateful to you and Chris and Dawn for keeping it going. I can't even tell you. I'm so honored to be. There's no other place I'd rather read in Pittsburgh than this series. It's the best. It gives Pittsburgh the best of Pittsburgh. The poets are amazing, and I am so excited to follow what I just heard. That was, yeah, like, how am I going to top that? Thank you. But I am going to start with that, you know, and it's not poetry, it's flash fiction, because I've turned my poetry into flash fiction. But this is a piece that means the entire world to me, because I wrote it probably 10 years ago, and it took a really long time. I swear, Ella McGrath Smith looked at it, she's like, I don't know, years ago. And finally, it got published by the Texas Review last year. It's not long. But I feel like it's very poetic. And it's called The Man on the Horse. I don't like men on horses. And the first part is called Fiction. First is the house. It is large and wooden, and there is smoke, which suggests that someone lives there. But the house is empty, empty and clean, which suggests someone lives there, but it is empty, except for the man. This is where the truth gets cloudy, the memory. Who knows if the narrator, that's me, can be trusted, her motives. Let's give her the wooden house and the man. Smoke and the smell of floor polish. The man is faceless and strong. He is not vindictive or mean. He is not nice. Part two, Frankenstein and the swing. The man appears in strange places, like at the rope swing in the girl's backyard. He watches the girl, who counts as she swings back and forth, toes dragging in a crushed clay gravel, drawing lines in red. When the girl looks up, she sees his face. It's kind of a Frankensteinian mold, not green, but cast of unowned parts. She is frightened, but more than frightened, she is sorry for him. This may be her biggest mistake. She continues swinging, counting until he leaves. He walks slowly, like a sewn-up man would. The part about him working in a mill is made up. In her mind, he works in the dark with fire. He is mighty and precise. He is skilled. She doesn't know why she gives him this. He is not apologetic. That would be worse. Mostly he shows up in the basement, the woods, the house, and sometimes on the bus. Most recently, he is a man on the horse wearing a cowboy hat, which she detests. When she sees him, it is not fear, but pain. When she closes her eyes to the smokestacks, the mill, the fire, she appreciates that he cleans what he can from his fingernails. She appreciates that he doesn't ask her not to tell. He knows she doesn't want to share this. What would she say? Frankenstein on the swing? It is hard growing apart from the man. She has known him forever. This means he has done his job well. He is proud, has a work ethic. She carries him with her, rough
fingers, swollen joints, closed palm into her grown-up life, which, like the swing, has a rhythm back and forth. She still drags her feet. Part 3, the naming. Characters need names, but the man remains nameless. The girl is called Anne without an E. Anne never calls out to the man or mentions him in a way that requires address. Sometimes she kisses boys and refuses to say their names. She has forgotten more than she remembers. Drinking has something to do with it. The man drinks, she drinks with him. It makes them feel better. Sometimes it goes bad. She doesn't blame the man for making her cry, for making her think about suicide. That gives him too much power. She adds an E to the end of her name. For a long time, the man leaves. Anne feels a hole in her she can't explain. Who will love her? Her with the hole. She walks down Darlington Avenue, feels the wind blow through the hole. A pipeline drilled straight through her, missing the heart. The cold makes a sound not unlike a fox caught in a trap, mournful and scared, the sound of the amputee, the healing over what's gone. The man remains nameless, but now has a sound. Part 4, bullet points. Jobs remain her focus. She has a work ethic rewarded by more work. Sometimes she feels an anger rise inside her, disproportionate. I think that's my phone. It is. Are you turning it off? Yeah, thank you. Her boss tells her the story is too long. Can she cut? Stick to smaller, more familiar words. The reader might be alienated by chic. She replaces it with fancy and transforms the prose to bite-sized bullet points, abandons transition. She pours a glass of cheap vodka and lets the rage settle, the ice melt. It doesn't matter. There are gaps in this story. It doesn't flow. Part 5. Inequity. But then there is love, which too is disproportionate. She understands inequity, the way she loves men way more than they do her, men who give her only part of what she wants. They're important parts, poetry, song, a deviance that allows her to relinquish control, if only in bed. They don't try to fix or fill her. They often leave once she brings up the hole, the sound, the fox. Nobody wants to marry a girl trapped like that. Part 6, the trap. Anne has learned to both set and trip the trap. She will not enter, no matter how starved. When the fox nears, she throws it bits of chicken from behind the trip plate, ushers it from ambush. Day and night, she stays like this, hiding her scent when the man approaches. He cannot smell her because she is a hole, a sound now, the wind. She is camouflaged with sorrow. The man set the trap to catch her, to catch the fox, to finish the game. But he tires of it, as men do. And when the weather turns cold, his visits become more infrequent. He feels a pulling apart, a detachment, a hole. Anne buys warm gloves, carries sardines, follows the fox far away. When the man returns in spring, he finds the trap vacant. Anne has left no tracks. Not the house, not the swing, not the bus, not the basement, only a meadow across the state line. Here in the meadow, the fox makes a den. Here the fox raises its kits. Here, Anne listens to the sound of herself dusted in pollen. Here, she takes the man apart and buries his pieces, places his hat on a small grave, a marker. Here, she lets the horse free.
That's a long piece. But I love it, and I swear to God, I would say to you that's the story of my life, and that it finally got published last year makes me happier. I don't have to do anything else ever again that makes me stupid happy. But here, because Silas, my son, read here a few weeks ago, which is super cool, and I love that he's a poet. I didn't train him that way. Of course I didn't. But he is, and he's a brilliant poet. But this is a poem for him, and it's called Everything Looks Like Bones to Me. The clouds, the moon, the occasional sliver of light, the shadows, the stone. I say femur, you say tibia. You know more than I, so I nod and keep looking. You have a fascination for skeletons, I for the things that hold us together. That is a mandible intact, you say. Put it in its own bag. Keep it safe. I follow your instructions, my little bone wizard, watching as you whisper a small prayer, as you pull matted fur from the spine. Later, I rescue a dead skunk from the road and give it to your bone world. You say, cleansing the bones honors the animal, its soul. I believe you and assist. I buy buckets for their bodies and chemicals. Together we work, mother and son. Bones are what we share. They will outlast us both. Carry the weight of our joy and sorrow. Carry the remains and the spirit, the piecing together, this simple act of love. That is for Silas. I love him so much. We have all kinds of little bone bodies in our basement. It's pretty cool. He's piecing them together. We're going to have a full opossum bone skeleton soon. This is for Riz because it's called 60 and Hot. And neither one of us are 60, but we're around there somewhere. So it's all working. The setting is soup, thick and simmering. Pittsburgh with its scorched steel glaze, the wave of Hephaestus' smokestack fury. Lover like longing, this steamy bath the conditioned air can't even penetrate as we idle in the shade of a borrowed shadow. We wear nothing that can't be removed. Whoops, I lost myself. Say nothing that can't be chilled with the cold body of regret, the frozen eyes of a deer. In this summer of sweltering, we give everything to fire, blazing together night after night, feeding yearning's furnace,
When I ask if you are cool enough, you say, "Am I?" in your dad joke voice. And even our laughter is hot on the tongue. Like this, day after day, we thrive despite, because, as if liquid, flowing, flammable, we are here to ignite and burn.
Okay, that was just a sex poem. Sorry about that. I don't know where I am time-wise. I'm at one more? Okay. This is called "The Elephant Was Never Invisible." The weight of her hoof on the settee, the damp on the rug where she lay, the house, a collection of jungle gossip. No need to address or undress her. She never wore or said a thing, just looked around for another pachyderm to blame. So many now. The doors need widening, the trunks tangled, and oh, the tusks. But still, no one apologizes or stops referencing her in the third person. The stench is all they mention. Patchouli, mildew, a hint of sorrow. So one day, she goes missing the way grudges do, weary of shame, and still, not a word. Just hearsay, rumors, lies. No note, no forwarding address. Her memory all but faded, thankful for the blessings of a thick skin. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Joan.